Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, one of your hosts, and I'm here with Colin Rose from Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario, to discuss his new book, A Renaissance of Violence, Homicide in Early Modern Italy, out from Cambridge University Press in 2019. Hello, Colin.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're super. We're about to have a heat stroke here, a hot spell in Amsterdam, but otherwise we're good.
That's good. Ours has just ended.
Oh, thankfully. Yeah, it's just, I am not a cold or a hot weather girl, despite working in Italy.
Well, that's why I go to Italy, to get away from the Canadian winters, right?
Sure, right. But yeah, not this summer. I'm sorry. No archival work for you.
Not yet. I'm trying to figure out how we'll do that in the near future.
Oh yeah, it can happen. Yeah. We'll get back to normal at some point, right?
Whatever normal will look like.
Whatever normal will look like, we say optimistically.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's turn to your book. So I like to ask my guests how they came to this work, and I'd like to do the same with you. I mean, it's very clearly a revision of your dissertation, right, which is its own sort of thing. But, you know, what brought you to the topic of homicide and early modern Italy?
So I have always, I've been interested in Italy since my undergraduate studies at the University of Toronto, where I was studying with Nicholas Terpstra, who was there. And there's sort of this wide community of early modern Italianists in Toronto. And you just got a lot of exposure there. I have no business being an Italian historian in terms of my background or anything, but it's such a fascinating and rich field, especially coming from such a concentration of scholars there. So I sort of got an early interest in it in my undergraduate studies. My undergraduate thesis ended up being on Florentine and Bolognese criminal courts, the development of justice and punishment systems in early modern Florence and Bologna. And then in my MA, I went out to Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and worked with Greg Hanlon there on an MA project on petitioning in 17th century in Italy. So I had sort of done these undergraduate and early graduate projects on institutions and bureaucracies around crime, sort of looking at justice as a series of institutions. And that got me wanting to sort of delve more into the experience of individuals, delve more into the sort of behavior that these institutions were attempting to sort of moderate or monitor or punish or reduce, et cetera, et cetera. So I sort of started thinking, well, maybe I want to study the actual crime itself instead of the systems around it. Homicide is historically the easiest crime to study. In a way that it's the most visible in the record. We talk a lot in the history of crime about the black figure of unreported or unknown crimes, particularly in things like robberies or domestic violence or assaults, just things that don't make it into the historical record, that don't make it into the criminal justice system, whatever that looks like. With homicide, there's usually a body. I mean, there's always a body. And there's often people who are aggrieved by that body. It comes to the attention of authorities. It comes to the attention of those who keep the records. So homicide gives you this access into a much bigger window of what crime or violence in a society actually looks like, because you have a pretty good sense that what you're seeing is more or less the accurate historical picture. When you say, I mean, I've counted up 100 homicides here, you can, there might be one or two that have gone unnoticed, but you're not talking about, well, I'm missing half the records or something like that. So violence sort of has this outsized place in historic societies compared to our own, which sort of brought me into the behavior itself, right? It's in early modern Italy, at least, it's kind of a part of the understood social repertoire that, you know, violence is going to be part of your life at some point. And so I wanted to understand how that kind of shapes people's experience of ordinary life, and to try to better understand, you know, what civil society can look like under those circumstances, when there's a much more acceptable place for violence in society than we have in our own today. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the academic reasons that brought me into homicide as a focus for this interest. On a personal note, like, I'm terrible at violence. I think I maybe got in one sort of schoolyard fight when I was grade six or something, and I didn't win. And I'm sort of fascinated by people who seem to have this either natural or even practiced skill at what we think of as a really aberrant set of behaviors, but which in historical settings they have in many cases been a real sort of benefit to be good at violence. So that's sort of the approach that brought me into studying homicide as an academic topic.
No, I mean, in this point about violence, it's very interesting, right? There's a whole group of people whose prowess of violence allows them power, mm-hmm. which is so interesting. When we think of a criminal class, it doesn't tend to be our upper class.
Well, the interesting part of that is that that power can be either, you know, extreme, right? You can win power over states through violence, or it can be really petty, right? I mean, so many of the characters in my novel are these kind of street urchins who are pretty good at fighting, and they get attached to a family. They get attached to an employer who needs someone who's good at violence, mm-hmm. and they get themselves a job, they get themselves a uniform, they get themselves a place to sleep, and they get this very petty social power, but it's more power than they would have had otherwise. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I suppose we can still see that happening, that last bit anyway. 100%. So my other question though, is why Bologna?
Why Bologna?
So many of us work in Venice. There's a big group in Florence. Why Bologna?
Bologna is not quite as visited as Florence, Venice, Rome by Anglo-American historians, but it's kind of this undiscovered gem, and I might be shooting myself in the foot by giving it away here. It's a wonderful city to work in. It has a vibrant intellectual life with the university there. The archive itself is freely accessible with, 8:30 to 7 p.m. days, Monday to Friday, and then, 8:30 to 1 o'clock on Saturdays. Yeah. 8:30 to 7 p.m. Just a fantastically accessible archive in a way that I've never experienced anywhere else. This probably will change soon enough with financial crises, et cetera, but it's a fantastic archive to work in, the Archivio di Stato di Bologna. There's also the old papal library, the Arcigenazio there, which has also a wonderful manuscript section. It's a very pleasant city to be an archival historian. And so I was drawn there by both the sort of rich history of the place, but also the working environment. There comes a point when, on a study of homicide as a topic, it could have been done in a variety of cities, right? But Bologna turned out to be probably the best place in Italy to do a kind of long-term archival study of criminal behavior. And it just happened to be that it's also a richly enjoyable city with fantastic food And so some really wonderful sites to see, situated in, you know, it's easily accessible from the other great parts of Italy. So it's a wonderful place. And while I encourage people to visit there, I would also recommend, if anyone is you know, looking for a city to study in Italy, that Bologna is a wonderful place to do it. But don't overcrowd my archive.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, as a Venetian historian, I like, and I know what that feels like. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, like, let's be reasonable. The best food in Italy, right?
Disagreed. Very good food. But the best food in Italy, and here again, I'm going to give away a secret. The best food in Italy is in Parma and then Modena.
Okay. Yeah. I would maybe Ravenna.
Okay. I believe it.
It's very good. But Trattoria Belle Arte is my favorite pizza in the world. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable.
When I'm in Bologna, I eat really sleazy. I go to this place called Nicolo's Pizzeria. You know, it's for €6. You get this 18-inch pizza sort of thing. And it's not the classiest place, but it is delicious.
Sounds fabulous.
Mm-hmm. I'm here by myself, right? So I bring my Kindle over to the restaurant and eat a huge pizza and then stagger home to fall asleep.
Sounds brilliant. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. We're getting a little off topic, but
I'll talk about Bolognese food for as long as I can.
Forever. And we're possibly like trying to convince people to study early modern Italy, which is a field that's not getting the love it used to.
Well, you see the lasagna in the records still. So every now and then I've seen a homicide case that starts with the poison lasagna or the incorrectly made lasagna.
I have seen this. I found a witchcraft trial. A woman put something in her lasagna to try to get her lover to stay with her.
It happens.
He and I'm quoting here, threw the lasagna out the window and she out of his house.
Ouch.
It was rough. Yeah. All right. So your historiography reads, as well as these things possibly can, it was actually quite enjoyable. And your work.
I cut about 30 pages of it.
The best. It's definitely necessary and often an evil, but you did a great job situating your work in the intersection of some very specific discussions and then some broader questions about, you know, the flow of Western civilization. Mm-hmm. So I just would like to know what you think your greatest contribution to our field is. What do you think you do here?
I think what I do is I've tried to use some long-term reliable evidence to mount a challenge to what has become the sort of dominant way of thinking about European violence, at least, which is that civilizing process theory that I spend a lot of time on in the book. It's really over the past, 25, 30 years, even closer to 40 years, largely through the work of Peter Spierenberg, and people who have been influenced by his work, it's become very much a dominant way of thinking about at least European patterns of not just violence, but state and social development. It has focused our attention on long-term processes and on sort of collections of large-scale numerical quantitative evidence without necessarily drawing us into the qualitative sort of momentary episodes that I think really make my study sort of a rich challenge to that. What I've tried to do in this book is say, look, this long-term process is great, and it's probably true, you know, if we look at the numbers, that over the past 500 years, there are fewer homicides now than there were in 1500. But by no means is that a sure thing. By no means is that a teleological process, and by no means is that even a continuous process. And so I've tried to marshal a significant body of evidence to say, here's you know, a moment in time, and I say a moment in time, I mean an entire century, where that process has been interrupted, has been reversed, and has to be kind of kickstarted again. And I've done that by drawing in the sort of other major processual school of my historiography, which is this much more American way of thinking about violence, influenced primarily by Randolph Roth, his sort of opus work on American homicide, which is to look rather than at state action and centralization as driving these long-term processes, but rather looking at it sort of kind of from the bottom up of how do people trust and respond to state action, institutional strength, legitimacy of institutions, to either to have much more sort of short-term analyses of the place of violence in a given society. So I've tried to take this perspective of, well, how do people experience state power and institutional action and respond to it either by using violence or abjuring violence? And I've taken this sort of large body of Italian criminal evidence, a larger collection of Italian homicide trials than have been collected before, and used it to put together this picture that says, no, we shouldn't be thinking about this in terms of a long-term decline of homicide brought about by state action. We should rather be thinking about this in terms of the strength of Italian civil society at various points in time, the strength of Italian social, political, judicial institutions at various points in time, and how those institutions have been able to meet the needs of or fail to meet the needs of local populations, elite populations, ordinary populations, et cetera, et cetera. I think my big contribution to this historiography is to say that we are way better off looking at moments in time. And again, that moment might be a whole century, then we are talking about a centuries long process that, you know, we're sort of apparently at the end of, even though who knows where it's going to go next year. That what we should be concentrating on is what happens, in the meantime, what happens, in a 30-year period, what happens in a 100-year period, rather than what's happened over the past six centuries. And if we do that, if we look at places where that pattern breaks, we start to see really interesting histories happening, such as what I've uncovered in Bologna, this hitherto sort of unnoticed revival of elite factional violence that really culminates in what is best described as a civil war in the middle of the 17th century, which if you weren't, you know, if you weren't looking at the homicide records, you wouldn't see this because it's not noted as a, you know, official civil war in the chronicle evidence. But when you look at who's being killed and in what kind of numbers and in what kind of circumstances, you start seeing that there's factional violence reemerging that's directed not just, you know, not just between different Bolognese factions, but actually challenging the legitimacy of papal authority over Bologna as well.
Sure. I mean, in some points right now, you've just answered kind of my next question, right? Because in your introduction, you lay out these statistics demonstrating this extremely violent, extremely homicidal points across the century. And I know the answer to this question is too big for a podcast. It is, in fact, a book. but why does this happen? What's the cause of the explosion of the violence here?
So there's, I mean, and here I what I also have just meant to tell you is that there's kind of two arguments going on, right? There's the local argument, the Bolognese argument, and then there's the universal argument, the social trust argument. In Bologna, I mean, the 17th century kind of starts on this high note, right? We're coming off what is traditionally thought of as the High Renaissance. The 16th century, the Italian states have kind of settled into these ducal absolutist situations where local elites have been, you know, pacified into a sort of service nobility, the Castiglione's courtiers are making up the local sort of political elites. The Spanish peace has descended upon Italy, et cetera, et cetera. We tend to think of, you know, the dawn of the 17th century as coming off this sort of productive time in Italian history. But then we see this sort of real decline in the fortunes of North Italy, at least. In the 1610s and 20s, there's a series of poor harvests related in part to sort of the ongoing issues of climate change in what's known as the Little Ice Age. So food insecurity is a real problem. The participation of Italy in this much broader global economy, much, you know, a sort of European and global economy, has sort of really damaged local industries, in particular the traditional textile industry, which is very important in Bologna in the late medieval and early modern period. So there's economic crises as well as food insecurity. In the 1620s, the 30 Years' War comes to Italy. There are Spanish and French and German armies kind of roaming through the Lombard Plain and the Po Valley. There are a couple battles fought in North Italy in the late 1620s. So you have all these soldiers around. And then in 1630, this all kind of comes to a head when there's a serious episode of bubonic plague. And this particular episode of bubonic plague for North Italy is probably the very worst one of the you know, 8 centuries in which bubonic plague sort of roams across Europe. In places like, well, in Venice, approximately half of the population dies. In Parma, about half of the population dies. In Padova, I think it might be 60% of the population. I don't have the numbers offhand in front of me, but it's these massive mortality numbers.
Right, yeah. Empty house after empty house.
Exactly. Left, yeah. And Bologna gets off comparatively easy with a mere, 25% of the population succumbing to the plague. And that's both in the rural and urban context. And this kind of brings everything to a head because this is not Northern Italy's first experience with plague, right? I mean, they've been dealing with it for 300 years and they think that they know how to deal with plague, right? They have a well-oiled machine of quarantine. They lock the gates against commercial goods coming from different cities, against livestock being transported in and out from the countryside into the city. They try and these cities have walls, so theoretically they are closable. And they try to, ward off plague through this set of protocols that have been developed over time, closing off the city. They have health magistracies who go around the city inspecting people's domiciles, looking for cesspools, filthy wells, all the sort of warning signs that, according to their understanding of disease theory, would warn them against outbreaks of plague. And they put this fairly harsh regime in place of quarantine, of curfew, shutting the city down, of a lockdown, of encouraging physical distancing, to try and bring this plague under control. And despite this, locking in Bologna, the curfew is a 24-hour curfew on women. They're supposed to stay inside all day long. It's a severe restriction on what kinds of economic activities can be performed in the marketplace. The butcher's district is cleared out. All of these, sort of vital economic lifelines in the city are severely curtailed. People chafe against it. Obviously, people break curfew. People break quarantine. People fake the sort of they call them fede di sanità, the health guarantee, right? The little card you carry around that says, "I don't have plague," or at least I didn't have plague when I left my city. People fake those. That there's always ways that people get around these things. And despite all the measures put in place by this state, 25% of the local population dies in Bologna. 50% of the local population dies in Venice, et cetera, right? So there's this kind of crashing realization that these states can't actually help us. The institutions who have seized a great deal of power in this moment, who have locked us in our homes for months at a time, have not prevented the deaths of thousands. So why are we trusting in these institutions to keep us safe? Why are we maintaining civil society on their terms? So we have this disappearance of trust in the legitimacy of political and social institutions. At the same time, as that population has this traumatic decrease in numbers, there's a sort of socioeconomic reckoning that happens, as we've seen in other places and times following severe plagues, right? That the have-nots say, well, being rich didn't prevent the haves from dying. Like, what is the basis for the socioeconomic hierarchies that under which I am a have not? And why shouldn't I be scrambling in the wake of this to try to get my hands on some more resources, some more land, trying to, you know, improve my station in the wake of this plague? So we see this kind of world turned upside down situation in which people kind of retreat into their kin groups. They retreat into self-help. We start seeing the growth of resource-based homicides, people scrambling for food, money, land. We start seeing the revival of sort of vendetta and revenge violence as people say, well, the institutions of the state aren't going to help me resolve these conflicts. And so this plague kind of just is the final nail in the coffin of these major crises that have dogged North Italian society through the early decades of the 17th century. And that's when we start to see this really major increase in homicide rates and also a qualitative shift in what those homicides look like. We start seeing more deliberately factional violence. We start seeing more resource-based violence. We start seeing the stability of civil society, which at normal times supports or sustains a degree of violence without really cracking at the seams. We start seeing the sorts of violence that indicate that civil society is really kind of falling apart, that the social trust that we would expect to see in a functional civil society has kind of fallen apart. That's sort of a local argument, if what I've already given you is the sort of big universal argument behind it, right? And Bologna makes a really good example of that universal argument that violence is a responsive behavior to the legitimacy of and social trust in the institutions that sustain civil society, whether those are judicial institutions, whether those are political institutions, whether those are social sort of informal institutions.
It's interesting that you're able to make these really kind of sweeping points with your sources, which are really atomized. And I think this might be a good time to talk about how you get there. How do you get to these points? Tell me about your primary sources. And for our listeners who haven't spent time in the archives, tell them a little bit what you're looking at, like how you come about this. Tell them how we do our craft.
So that's a good question. That's a very good question. So the bulk of what I do as a historian, at least for this project, the bulk of what I did was read historical murder trials. It was a bit of a depressing project, as you can imagine. But the record of violence in Bologna is largely conserved in the Archivio di Stato di Bologna, the state archive, in the records of a really sort of frighteningly powerful criminal court known as the Tribunale del Torrone, the Tribunal of the Great Tower, which emerges as an arm of papal power in the 16th century, largely in order to wrest criminal jurisdiction away from local feudal elites. And in many ways, this court does so by having a meticulous bureaucracy, right? It's got notaries trained at the university in Bologna and trained at the university in Padova, who form these sort of, if the pen is mightier than the sword, then these guys have the pens. And they are fearsome notaries in terms of the records that they are keeping of judicial activity. So this court emerges, the earliest records of it are around 1525, when the early 16th century popes are really struggling to sort of oust local elites from criminal jurisdiction. By the 1550s, this court, the Torrone, is firmly established. And by the 1570s, its records are remarkable for their comprehensiveness and for their complexity. And so I'm reading homicide trials, and these trials frequently start with a denunciation or a report by an aggrieved party or by a local judicial official, sort of a cop known as a spiro or a bargello, who writes a report to the court, says someone's been killed. Giovanni has killed Marcello, et cetera, right? And they give a little overview of the situation. So this is always nice when you're starting to read a trial that the very first pages are someone saying, here's what I heard happened. Exactly, right? Here's the major narrative that you're about to read through and that you're about to complicate. Following this sort of initial denunciation, the court determines whether or not to investigate, dispatches a judge or a notary or both. When they get to the scene of the crime, there's a section of the documents, which is body inspections, where they do basically an on-site autopsy, not like a forensic autopsy, but an inspection of the corpse when they say, and this is great material history, right? They describe a corpse, age, sex, hair color, whether they have a beard, whether they have a mustache, what they're wearing, what's in their pockets, what kind of wounds they have, whether those wounds are deemed to have been fatal. And these are always performed either by, usually by a physician or a barber surgeon who's on site, and then two witnesses who know the deceased, so they can sort of, you have this sort of here's the medical side of it, this is a body that was killed by someone, you know, this wound did the deed, and then you have two people who will say I know who that person is, and then you have a notary who will say, and this qualifies as a homicide. So you have sort of the social, medical, and legal perspectives brought into this body inspection. If the body inspection indeed points to a homicide, then the criminal court, the notary, and the judge will begin, they'll open an investigation. And all of this is recorded on site. You have these reams of paper, compiled into codex style books. I sometimes imagine these notaries sort of traveling around with just thick sheaves of pages. Some of it's done on site, some of it's copied into investigation books later. With the body inspections complete, we move on to investigations, and these investigations are typically witness interrogations. So the notary will say, okay, say we've got this body, they will call, they'll speak to his friends, and I say his because it's usually a his. They'll speak to family, they'll speak to local notables, you know, the local blacksmith, people who see everything. They frequently have a pretty good idea of who the culprit is. They will speak to, if that person's in custody, they will interrogate that person. More often than not, that person has fled, in which case they will organize a search party and try to find them. And then depending on, you know, the nature of the investigation, the complexity of it, we'll have anywhere from, you know, 3 to 50 witnesses called in a typical homicide trial. These can last anywhere from, you know, 5 pages of handwritten documentation to over 1,000, depending on the complexity of the trial and the number of witnesses called. With all the evidence from witness interrogations collected, the judge makes a preliminary charge. Citations are issued for the accused to appear, to mount a defense with or without a lawyer, usually without a lawyer. Typically a killer does not appear, because you're handing yourself over to an authority that will probably level a sentence of death against you. In absentia, you are sentenced. More often than not, that sentence is written out as sort of exile on pain of death. If you do show up, you'll receive your death sentence. Sometimes it's exile on pain of galley slavery, going to row papal galleys in the Mediterranean, fighting pirates. Which is
for a very long time.
It's a functional death sentence, right? I mean, if you're sentenced for 10 years galley slavery, that's a functional death sentence. Sometimes you would be sentenced to working in the salt mines. Sometimes you would be sentenced to prison terms. But the typical way that a homicide trial ends is with a sentence of exile on pain of death, or pain of galley slavery. And that's just sort of a recognition of the actual situation, because what's happened in the meantime is that the killer has fled to the next state over, right? One of the things about Bologna's sort of fracturing into these city-states across North Italy, or sorry, not Bologna's, Italy's fracturing into these city-states, is that in order to escape a criminal jurisdiction from Bologna, you just have to cross the river over into Modenese territory. And then there's at least a long extradition process that gives you some time to breathe. In that time to breathe, the notaries of the court are leaning heavily on the victim's family to reach out and negotiate a peace accord with the killer, with the eye to preventing a cycle of revenge violence from breaking out. And then if that peace accord is successfully negotiated, a pardon is granted. There's often a sort of kind of restraining order. You'll stay away from this family for 5 years, but otherwise you could come back to your town. And what we're not going to have is the sort of revenge violence that really disrupts the stability of local society. And all of this in Bologna, part of what makes Bologna such a rich archival place to work, all of this is conserved in one booklet. That's also, you know, what makes Bologna great. If you go to somewhere like Florence to study criminal records, you have the denunciations in one folder, you have the trials in another folder, you have the sentences in another folder, and you have the pardons in another folder. In Bologna, they're all in one book.
Some of those could have been lost or whatnot. So yeah, that's very nice. It's,
yeah, exactly. It makes it a really comprehensive criminal archive. And it makes it, you know, I'm not going to say it's easy to read through, but it's relatively straightforward to track down. I mean, I ended up with something like 700 odd trials. When you're trying to vacuum up that amount of data, having it easily accessible and comprehensively organized is really important. So, you know, it's kind of, my primary sources are these sort of booklets of handwritten, the bulk of the material is witness interrogations. And, for our listeners, I'll give you a sense of what this actually looks like, because you get a real sense of, how hard the notaries behind the system actually work. Sometimes you'll have 15 witnesses interviewed in a day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the day will start on a fresh page, in the booklet, and our notary has this sort of very neat, you know, sort of notarial hand. His ink is running smoothly, his quill is sharp, and the questioning begins. And the questions are often very formulaic. A judge or a notary is asking, okay, tell us your name, who are you, how do you know the victim, can you tell us what happened? And then follow-up questions. You know, if someone says, well, I saw, you know, I know that Giovanni killed Marcello. Okay, well, why did he do it? They were arguing over, who's the boundaries of their fields. Okay, do you know how long those boundaries have been established, et cetera, et cetera. We have these sort of series of questions that lead into follow-up questions as an interrogation generally would. And so maybe each witness takes up 3 pages. You've got 15 pages or 15 witnesses in a day, maybe. By the end of the day, the poor notary's hand, you can just see the cramps in his handwriting, right? It's just become this kind of chicken scratch. His quill is dull. The ink is sort of all over the place. It becomes much less legible. And these witness interrogations are a fantastic insight into daily life of ordinary people, because often what they're doing is they're telling stories. What were you doing that day? Right. How do you know this happened? Well, I was on my way to visit my sister-in-law. We were going to make the pasta for that week, you know, for the feast day coming up, et cetera, et cetera. Or I was off to the fields to look after the beasts, because, you know, that's my job, et cetera, et cetera. I was working on a roof repairing thatch, and when I saw this, you get these very mundane, ordinary stories, which are interrupted by acts of fatal violence. So all of this is written down about as close to word for word as you can imagine. So these notaries are working fearsomely hard, and there's always this ongoing question of, well, can you trust the notary? Can you actually sort of expect that what you're reading is an accurate reflection of what's being said here. And when you read these, mm-hmm. when you read the mundanity of much of this testimony, you sort of say, yeah, they're writing down what they're being told.
You know, and
why would
there? Well, I think there are other little clues as well, just to how handy they are, how careful they are. I have found cases where they bring someone in and they're like, so do you know why you're here today? And mm-hmm. they say, no, I do not know. And I cannot imagine.
Exactly.
And, non posso immaginare. Yeah. And then the inquisitor starts asking them questions, and then they realize that they have the wrong guy. They've got like Piero who lives in this calle, and they wanted Piero who lives over on the other calle.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, we'll let you go. And that's still in the record, mm-hmm. which is, you know, further to your point that this is really, you're getting a blow by blow. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's really important, though, to point out, I think when people imagine, you know, just like what early modern justice looks like, it's big and it's epic and it's exciting. And what it is, in fact, is fearsome bureaucracy.
100%.
You get these, there are armies.
These merciless pedants.
Merciless pens and armies of bureaucrats and pounds of paper that are actually what controls or mandates or, you know, how you negotiate.
When you see the shelves, right? When you go into the back room of the archive and you see it's kilometers of shelves, mm-hmm. right? When you stack up all of the records of you know, even it. So I think it's in a year of criminal records in Bologna, there's anywhere between, let's see, the biggest year, I think I had 300 case books, each about 300 folios, mm-hmm. right? There's just a massive amount of paperwork that is generated by this meticulous, incredibly annoying bureaucracy, right? Oh, these notaries must be just the least fun in the world. And it's boring work too, right? I mean, they're sort of writing, and then they have these breaks, right? And what do they do in their break time? They draw cartoons, right? They color in the margins. They draw funny little pictures, or they write little poems, or
in their spare time they write magic charms or something,
exactly,
which they
might
get in trouble later. So mm-hmm. it seems unbearable. But then when you think about what their other options are, maybe it's all right.
But as a historian, right? I mean, well, this is why people study Italy. Is mm-hmm. that this notarial culture is so embedded into statehood in the Italian cities that they're just brutal record keepers, records of every little thing, every word said, every dollar or every, you know, scudo passed over, just every sound. Little thing.
Yeah. The sounds that are included in the interrogation. It's really interesting.
Oh yeah. Well, the other part I should add about what these sources look like is that they reflect real actions, right? And so, you know, the notaries they're writing down not just the responses to questions, but also the behaviors of the people, right? And so you have to also the elephant in the room of these records is torture, right? Not just torture of accused, but torture of witnesses who have, you know, nothing to do with it really. If the court doesn't think that they trust a witness, they can apply torture there. There's a growing discomfort with that in the early modern period. A lot of jurists recognize that torture isn't really effective at accessing truth. But the notaries are still there writing it down, right? And probably the hardest thing I ever read in the archive was just a 3-page transcription of screams.
Oh God.
It was awful, right? Yeah. Mother Mary, please make this stop. Help. Jesus, help. Right. And the notary, the notary's sitting there duly recording, keeping an accurate record of this torture transcript that was literally, it was just screams. So that's the, you know, when we're talking about how great these records are, we also have to recognize that this is a brutal system too.
Absolutely. Not probably as bad as most people think.
No.
There is due process.
And the torture is ordinary. We're not talking about, burning people's feet and stuff like that. It's a bureaucratic kind of torture. For listeners not familiar with early modern torture, it's very standard. It's called the strappado in North Italy, and it's a rope torture where they tie your hands behind your back. They attach a rope on a pulley to that hand tie and they lift you off the ground. It dislocates your shoulders. It doesn't do any permanent damage, which is the sort of legal standard of acceptable torture. That you will heal from it. There's a series of exceptions for people who can't be tortured. I often see people in the record, they bring in their doctor's note, right? I've got a bad back. Here's my physician's note saying I can't be tortured because I have a herniated disc. It will cause permanent damage if you torture me, so you can't do it. Or I'm pregnant, so you can't torture me yet. There's all these general legal literacy about torture, about participation in this system that people have. So it's kind of an oppressive system of state justice interrogating ordinary people, but there's also this widespread legal literacy of how to work in that system that we see emerging from these sources where people are, you can tell they're playing the system, right? In many ways, they know what questions they're going to be asked and they know how to answer them. And this becomes very true. So when you're out in, when a notary has been called out to the countryside, there's this little village where a stranger has showed up on market day selling something in the market square. He gets into a fight with a local. The local knifes him. This outsider comes into town and ends up killed. And then the local boy who's done the killing takes off. He goes running, and there's this process that is off the page, but you can see the traces of it, of the village getting together and saying, okay, what do we tell the court? What's our story here? And then the notary shows up because they have to report the body, so the local sort of bailiff figure has to report the body into the court. The notary shows up, and he says, okay, well, where's the killer? And everyone says, oh, I don't know. And they say, well, let's go find him. And he says, oh, we last saw him. He crossed the river over that way into Modena, or he crossed into the mountain passes heading towards Florence. We'll never find him. Okay, sit down. What happened here? And you start seeing, the answers are so rehearsed that they've gotten together and said, what's the story? What happened here? How do we explain this in a way that will protect local interests and will keep the court happy while also keeping them out of our hair as much as possible, while ensuring that as few of us get tortured as possible?
Absolutely. And, that's part of a much broader debate about the way government works, mm-hmm. and the way, the way that these kind of mechanisms work, and how there's this negotiation of power being exercised from above and below. Which we really don't have time for.
No, that's fair. That's a much bigger question.
It's a big question. Yeah,
I will say one thing about that, which is that, when you look at the amount of, not power, but the amount of leeway that ordinary people have in their relationships with authorities, you start seeing that in early modern. I don't know if you agree with this at all. I think the emperor has no clothes. Mm-hmm. I mean, Venice is a particular place, but the ducal states of North Italy, I mean, the state is powerless in so many ways. That kinship is still much more important. That community is still much more powerful in shaping people's lives and shaping people's experiences.
Sure. And it's this kind of negotiation, mm-hmm. right? Especially, I mean, with Venice, the papacy is particularly neutered, but,
exactly.
It's absolutely, there's this space, this narrative, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but this narrative that the 17th century in particular is about the centralization of power and the growing authoritarianism. And perhaps that applies in a place I don't understand, France.
But it's not true in Italy. I mean, there's attempts at that, but it's still very much these much older structures of community loyalty, of kinship loyalty, that, you know, even if at a given moment, right? I mean, the elites of Bologna said, okay, we're gonna join this papal senate, right? We're gonna get in that papal senate, but they're using it to advance their own interests. They're using it to build family power. They're using it to sort of leapfrog from the heights of Bolognese social power to join this broader network of Italian elite families and get into Rome, right? Or get into France. Statehood and state politics are an avenue for these elite families to advance their family interests, rather than, you know, they're not working for the good of the centralized state.
No. Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree with you there.
Cool.
We've solved one of those problems. Yeah. That's good. No one needs to write any more books about that, guys. We got it.
Done. State is out. I said that at the AHA. I was at the AHA in January and ended up on this panel about state power somehow. And I sort of started my paper and said, I didn't think this was about state power. I didn't want to talk about state power.
It went well. Back when we got to see other people.
Those were the days. Remember those days. Yeah. The last conference I'll ever go to was AHA in New York.
that can't be true.
I hope not.
God, it's not, it's nobody's favorite, is it?
No, it's a strange time. But well, I take solace in knowing that we're not the first people to ever go through a plague, right? The world has continued in many plagues before. There will be something on the far side eventually.
Yeah, we will get out of it. Maybe we'll get a good church out of this or something, as we did in Venice.
So do you know this this town in Germany, Oberammergau, I think it's called, where there's a passion play that was started in the 1630 plague, and this small town in Bavaria said, okay, we're going to put on this passion play, and they made a voto that if the passion play broke the plague, they would put it on every 10 years in perpetuity. And lo and behold, they put on this passion plague in October, and they didn't have any more cases of plague anymore because plague subsides in the late fall. And so every 10 years since 1630-ish, this town has put on this passion play. It's gone on for 400 years. The only times it's ever been delayed was once in World War I, and once in, I think the 1980s pandemic. I had tickets. My wife and I were going to go this year. It was supposed to happen this year. Yeah, we were going to go see this famous passion play, and it's been delayed for the third time in its 400-year history.
That's astounding.
I sort of thought, well, aren't you going to put the damn passion play on? Like, break the plague, guys?
Seriously, can we get some help here?
So I hope that they've at least performed it, in private for the town.
I hope so as well. Yeah. Which really connects us to kind of, I like that moment to connect this to this broader, our broader history that we're part of. Okay. We have inadvertently kind of talked about most of the things I wanted to talk to in this very far ranging discussion. So I think we should just, and in the interest of our listeners' time, we should kind of wrap this up. Okay. You know what? One of the things that you say, the plague, let's talk about the plague in the middle of this, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, that you kind of point out that the plague destabilizes, kind of physically, metaphorically, the plague destabilizes. And then the violence, the homicide that comes as a response, reestablishes?
No.
Okay. No. Okay.
Sorry. That's not really what I. No. Ooh. I hope I didn't say that.
No.
What I mean is that.
I was reaching. So that's one of my questions.
The violence that comes after kind of forces the reestablishment.
Okay.
Right. There's this. And if you look at this, might be a particularly Bolognese process as well. But because of its extremely fractious, factional elite history that the elites of Bologna have, for since the founding of the communes, have been notoriously violent in their politics. And that doesn't just disappear in the early 16th century when Julius II sort of officially reintegrates Bologna into the papal state as a practical matter, not just a sort of nominal matter. It seems to me that there's this sort of generational process where each new generation of elites has to sort of renegotiate, reestablish the terms under which they're going to participate in this broader papal state project. And so you see kind of almost every 30 years, looking at Bolognese history, you see this kind of crumbling and then a reestablishment, right? You see sort of Senate participation falls off, and then the Pope offers, I'll give a whole bunch of land grants in the 1560s to various families that were previously oligarchic supporters. Now that they've got these big land holdings in the countryside, they're going to come back into the fold. And there's these sort of back and forths kind of every generation where the Bolognese elites say, okay, we're gonna be a part of this papal state project. And the fallout after the 1630 plague is another of those moments. And it takes a long time. Because the 1630 plague, and here I'm gonna get, you know, this is something I try not to get into too much in the book because I'm not like 100% sure that I have the evidence for this. But what I see happening, the 1630 plague is one of the, you know, there's two kinds of plagues, right? There's the one that kills the adult generation, kills the healthy adult generation, and then there's one that kills the old and the young. The 1630 kills the healthy adult generation. So you have this whole generation of elites who are children around 1630 who grow up without fathers. And by the time those, so they grow up without what would become the mediating influences of their youth and early adulthood, right? By the, you know, so that these, say, 30-year-old to 40-year-old fathers are gone as their sons are going from being 5 to 25, 5 to 35. So we don't have a generation of Bolognese elites who are sort of over their violent youth. In the wake of this plague, the young generation of Bolognese elites are growing up without their fathers there to say, here's how you work in this political system. Here's how you reestablish stability around here. So they just keep at it. They don't have that mediating influence of their fathers who are becoming old men who are tired of violence. And so it continues for another 30 years. They return to the factional politics, they return to the vendetta, they return to revenge, they return to anti-papal agitation, they kill judges, they kill notaries, they kill spiri. And it takes 30 years for that to sort of calm down until the 1660s. And eventually it kind of gets calmed down by force. There's this mass exile of elite heads of households. And then the papacy eventually just says, look, we're just get out of here. Leave. Any member of these families is proscribed and they kind of start again. It's a sort of, you can only come back if you're going to join the fold again. And I know I'm getting kind of crazy here with the sort of theorizing about generational loyalties and stuff like that, but this is what I see happening, is that there's this frighteningly long outbreak of violence because there aren't the mediating influences of a missing generation of fathers who grow old, right? And as you grow old, you sort of are less violent. This is typically how violence functions, right? It's very much a young man's game. And these fathers are not there to teach their sons politics. Because I mean, as I said earlier, right, like politics are all about families. And so without that, you know, you have a whole bunch of Mercutios growing up. You know, so it's this sort of wild process that takes a long time to get under control. And the violence really, you know, does prompt, a long process of reestablishing that process by which Bolognese elites will participate in papal society kind of on their own terms. And it's also not a, I mean, that's, you know, the book ends, but the history doesn't, right? We see some, you know, there's feuds breaking out in the 1690s. There's feuds breaking out in the early 18th century. That it's an ongoing process. It's not like it's ever done. I mean, Napoleon kind of interrupts it at the end of the 18th century, but it still kind of continues. I mean, there are people who probably have their traditional enemies in Bologna today. I know. Yeah. I mean, I've got a colleague who works in Modena, Amanda Madden, and she certainly has existing descendants of feuding families from the 16th century who she's spoken to in Modena. So,
well, there's no reason to just let that go.
Well, exactly.
You know, that's blood's blood there.
And it's this is your hometown. And for families, right? I mean, it's one thing to say that in a colonial setting like Canada, where it's like, this is your hometown, sure, whatever. But in Italy, it's like, this is your hometown and it has been for 1,000 years.
Yeah, like when you see people, you know, there are families here in Amsterdam where I live now, and they are in the palace. Like they're
exactly.
living.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Family built in the 17th century when Amsterdam was getting rich.
Or in Bologna, they're living in the family palace that was built in the 13th century, which is also a museum.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And God knows Florence, right? I just read some statistic about what percentage of Florentine wealth is.
Oh yeah. I remember that study drawn out of the Catasto, right? Where you see the families, Ferragamo and.
Wow. Yeah.
Prada, all these names dating back to the 15th century, right?
Goodness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. And that probably, I mean, this is the way you conclude the book is with going the discussion of from the immediate post 1630 years to the 1660s. And I think we can, we've gotten to that at least enough. And if not, my hope is that this is tantalizing because I think this is a book that's really enjoyable to read.
Thank you very much.
My hope is that this conversation won't sate our listeners, but will instead encourage them to read more. But so what's next for you? Or is it still homicide?
No. So, I mean, one thing I haven't actually got into at all is that I have a whole other side to me as a historian, which is not just a criminal archive rat, but I am I'm also a digital historian. My official job title is Assistant Professor of European and Digital History. And so I have for many years, I've had these two separate projects. I had the homicide project, and then I had a historical GIS project, which I'm sort of the co-director with Nick Terpstra, called the DECIMA, the Digitally Encoded Census Information and Mapping Archive, which is a historical GIS of 16th century Florence, where we have taken a series of censuses from the 16th and early 17th century in Florence and mapped them onto contemporary map images, as well as sort of a Google Maps interface. You can Google it. It's DECIMA, DECIMA. And I've now, my next project is a project integrating the sort of social historical GIS and the violence studies. I'm doing a project coming up on, it's called Mapping the Crimescape of Early Modern Florence, or maybe Mapping the Crimescape of Renaissance Florence, because that, you know, sells books. And what I'm doing is I'm going to get into the criminal records of 16th century Florence, and I'm going to look for locational clues, and I'm going to try to map out the activities of a police state. The focus is going to be less on the crime and more on the court activity, sort of how it is gendered, how it is classist, what sort of sexual politics are at work in police activity, what sort of racial politics are at work in police activity. Trying to do a kind of expose on the Florentine police from a spatial perspective. So there's going to be some layers built for the DECIMA GIS system, sort of mapping out the activity of the Otto della Guardia, as well as the Onesta court, as well as the Note court, the three sort of crime and decency courts in Florence. We're going to map out prosecutions and investigations by them within the sort of context of the census data that we have from the 16th century. So looking at the sort of socioeconomic patterns of not crime specifically, but of police activity, actually. Kind of trying to catch out police corruption and such like that.
Oh, that's so very cool.
Yeah, I hope so.
That'll be exciting. And can you see work with the great and good Nicholas Terpstra, one of my favorite historians?
He was my undergraduate mentor and then my PhD supervisor. I've known him for a long, long time. He is one of the greats for sure.
Oh, yeah. I wrote a book, a review of Lost Girls, and I probably shouldn't have been. Nice. I'm as much as a middle-aged historian can be, I am a fangirl.
I'll tell him that. I'll pass this on to him, and I'm sure he'll appreciate that.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you so much. This has been a really fun conversation.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this.